Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
You're listening to The Takeaway Podcast. You can also find us on Twitter at The Takeaway and on Facebook at facebook.com/The Takeaway.
Welcome to The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. I hope everyone had a great Thanksgiving and has lots of containers full of fabulous feast fixings, right? Surplus from all your efforts either to embrace or to perhaps avoid this most communal of American holidays. Well, you know, we find ourselves with a surplus too today, a big bag of stories from you who challenge us every day with responses, insights, contributions to this program. We couldn't do this show without you answering our call for stories, for you to share what you know. And this hour, it's not just the 20-second blurbs you hear each day. Nope. For so many of you, we wanted to know more, ask you some questions, get the backstory. And often, you added to conversations we were already having. Like when we did our series on caregivers and mentioned more than once that 65 million Americans play the role of caregiver one way or another.
Work is a very large part of my identity. So you can't give up something that's that central and be a care provider without resentment.
You know, you get so burnt out and you don't see relief.
There's a crash course, you know, in caregiving.
I feel tormented. I feel like there's no good option. And what a parent really wants, I think, when your kid grows up is to feel that they're in a place where they belong.
Some of the 65 million out there we heard from, people caring for loved ones who we simply wanted to recognize for their hard work day in and day out with so little recognition from anywhere else. We heard from Anil Lewis. He's the Director of Advocacy and Policy for the National Federation for the Blind, and he had an amazing story for us. Anil is blind, and for much of his youth, it was his mother who cared for him. But then the tables turned, and it was Anil who served as the primary caregiver to his mother for the last year of her life as she battled cancer. And he had the additional responsibility of being the single parent to his son. Anil told us, as sad as he was about his mom, he found out he was in fact well prepared for this challenge.
My mom, just in an amazing way that she lived, just did it. And I think that she instilled that into all of her children as well. There's a fundamental responsibility that we as individuals have to one another. And she recognized that and stepped up to that. And we, as children, feel the same way.
Now, your mother, of course, was your caregiver, as all moms are.
Absolutely.
But in a very special way, because of your blindness.
Absolutely. It's important to understand that both my older brother and older sister went blind before me. So she had a little bit of experience in basically the pitfalls of being, quote unquote, a caregiver because of the disability. And she evolved, luckily, by the time I became blind to a person that empowered me to still own my own life. I think that what happened is my mom got to a point where she realized that if she continued to custodialize us, then we would always be forever dependent on her. So what she did was she provided us with the necessary intervention until we got to the point where we could make those accommodations to access different areas of information and environments on our own. So yes, she was my reader to the point where she helped me until I learned to read Braille and learned to use assistive technology. And she was my driver until I got to the point where I was able to schedule my own trips and hire my own drivers. So I think that the beautiful part of her, and I guess it's in a sense what most caregivers do, they provide the care that's necessary and encourage individuals to become or maintain whatever degree of independence they can. And through that model, I was able to do the same when she was stricken with the cancer.
At the moment that you learned that she really had a cancer situation that was very much life-threatening, how did she ask for help? How did you understand you would need to step up? And how worried were you about that?
Yeah, the biggest transformation, of course, is recognizing that the strong woman who has been your rock for so many years is now going to be dependent upon you. And in the beginning, it really wasn't overwhelming. It was just a matter of helping her schedule her chemotherapy appointments. And at that beginning, she was able to drive back and forth to the appointments. So I would just go with her to the doctor. But as the cancer progressed, I had to coordinate transportation. It was a slow evolution to my increased responsibility for being her caregiver. First, it was scheduling appointments. Then it was coordinating drivers. And as she deteriorated, it was me preparing meals. And then I started being responsible for taking her vital signs for the doctor. So her blood pressure and her glucose measurements, I started doing those using assistive technology. There's talking blood glucose monitors and talking blood pressure monitors that I was able to use to do those things. So it was a progressive kind of gradual increase in my responsibility. And here again, back to the model that she set, it was a responsibility that I just did kind of innately, just naturally stepped up to that. And here again, it wasn't anything phenomenal or miraculous or inspiring. It was my responsibility.
Did anybody ever, looking from the outside, maybe insensitively but not with malice, suggest, you know, your mom needs somebody who's sighted here. Maybe, Neil, you should step out of the way and we get a nurse in here.
Absolutely. I mean, the first piece is recognizing within myself that I could do it, because I had those initial questions myself. And as I evaluated it, I said yes, because I had a different component that none of the other medical professionals possessed, and that was I loved her unselfishly. That was a battle that, you know, as a blind person, I have to face every day anyway, changing society's perceptions about my capacity as a blind person. And thankfully, I was around individuals who were willing to understand and really believe in that capacity.
So, Anil, in the emotional conversations that you had with your mom towards the end, you must have learned how much hard work it took to be a caregiver for all of you and your siblings.
Absolutely. But I remember sitting there saying, I'm having this difficulty with just two people that I'm the primary caregiver for. Her life of taking four, I would just marvel. And I just asked her, how did she do it? And it was really kind of funny, because when she'd answer and says, I don't really know, I never really thought about it. As I reflect back on the time I was doing the same for her and my son, I really don't know. I mean, I look at the things that I had to do, and I don't even recognize how I was able to get it done in the days that I had to do it. So I think it goes back to that conviction. And I think that all caregivers have this, right? Or else they wouldn't be caregivers. You know that it's something that has to be done, and you do it. You find a way to do it. You don't question, you know, can I? You just do it.
Anil, when your mom finally passed, what was it like experiencing both emptiness and freedom?
Realistically, a lot of the pain that I would have experienced upon her passing, I experienced during those times when she was at her worst. So I guess I was essentially all cried out. And I remember at her funeral, and I never would have thought that this was possible, there was such a sense of joy. Because I knew that, here again, she was in a better place. And I knew, well, it's just such a sense of joy. Yeah, the most profound moment of my life, and something that still sticks with me through that whole experience, is at one point, you know, she needed more care than I could give her. She needed people to make sure that she was turned so that she wouldn't get bed sores. And I was able to do that, but near the end, even the OxyContin painkiller she was taking didn't prohibit her from feeling the pain. And when you would turn her, she would cry in agony. And because I loved her, that made it more difficult for me to balance. You know, I knew that she needed to be turned so that she wouldn't get bed sores and she wouldn't get a more complicated medical experience, but I just couldn't hear her crying out in pain. So she was near the end. They gave us a prognosis of, I think it was maybe 4 months to live. So we transferred over into hospice. And I remember at the end, she had fallen into a diabetic coma. And I sat outside her room, and the hospital chaplain came by. And he listened to me about 45 minutes go on about, I should have done this, and maybe I should have done this. Because I still had questions as to whether I did everything right or whether I did anything wrong. He listened to that, and then he said, I've been listening to you for the last 40 minutes. And he says, you've been asking yourself whether you've done what was right or what was wrong. And he says, I just want to let you know that in this situation, there is no right or wrong. He says there's faithful and there's unfaithful. And he says, by all accounts, everything you've told me has been faithful. And that was a burden lifted. Those simple words made me understand that what I did was the right thing to do. And then he also told me, he says, I should go see the social worker. And I didn't know exactly why, but I went to see the social worker. And she explained to me in simple terms. She says, many individuals are really just holding on, you know, for the people they love. And I come to understand that we get selfish. We don't want that person to leave, even though I have a faith that knows she's on to a better place. But I didn't want her to go. I wanted my mom. So she says, go talk to her. She said, go talk to your mom and go tell her that, you know, you're going to be okay and the family's going to be okay and that she needs to make the decision that she needs to make. So I went to her bedside and I started talking to her, even though she was in the coma. And I told her I'd be okay. And I told her, you know, that make sure that the family was all right and went down the whole list and told her. And I leaned over, I kissed her on the forehead, and I said, I love you. And this is stuff made for TV, right? I mean, people think that it's not real, but at that point, she came too. She opened her eyes and she told me, I love you too. And I know that she went on knowing that everything was going to be okay. And since she passed in 2000, I worked diligently to make sure that my family is all right. And I know that she's looking down on me, and I hope to God that she's proud of what I'm doing.
You know, they don't have schools for caregivers. They don't have awards for caregivers. They don't have retirement programs for caregivers. But that's quite a profession, Anil.
Yeah. And that's why I thought the piece that you did on this was so powerful, so important. Because as I took care of my mom, I vanished, you know. And it was so interesting, you know, when people would come by and visit her, she would always get up so that no one would really worry about her. So she'd sit up from her seat and put her best foot forward and laugh and enjoy. But that would take so much out of her. And I remember when they would leave, she would just crash. And I would have to make sure that she was comfortable. And she'd have to rest hour after hour to make sure that she recuperated. But, you know, they came to see her. And I was kind of a fixture. But the reward, the appreciation, I mean, it's very nice to have. But I think that overall, I did it, right? And she expected me to do it. And she would have done the same without hesitation.
Call me crazy, but I think I hear a little bit of her voice talking to me right now.
I hope so. That to me would be the most extreme compliment. If I can be as strong a person as my mom and committed to helping others like my mom did, then yeah, thank you for that.
Anil Lewis is the Director of Advocacy and Policy for the National Federation of the Blind. He's a Takeaway listener who called us to share his story about caring for his mom during her battle with cancer. More of your stories all this hour. Coming up, we've spent some time on the Takeaway talking about the evolving attitudes of millennials when it comes to faith and religion. One Takeaway listener tells us her incredibly complex journey in navigating her faith and about the many bumps in the road.
When I was 20, could I have imagined that I would have been Catholic, Protestant, Jewish, and married an Episcopal priest? No, I would have told you were absolutely out of your mind. But now that I'm here, I really can't imagine being anywhere else.
That's coming up here on The Takeaway. Stay with us.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International, in collaboration with the New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Last month, we aired a series of interviews with millennials, you know who you are, born after 1980, who opened up about leaving the religion they were raised in, or in some cases, dramatically reinterpreting it on their own. We heard from first-generation Muslim Americans trying to find their way within a culture that their parents and religion don't always agree with. We talked with young Jews who consider themselves Jewish by culture only, and young Christians who lost their faith as they entered adulthood, choosing to identify as atheist or merely humanist. These Americans represent a generational trend, young people moving away from organized religion at an unprecedented pace. And those who do remain are often less religious than their parents. As we wrapped up that series, Krista Tippett, host of the show On Being, told us that this shift we're seeing could ultimately be for the good.
We may look back 50 years from now and say, This was a force for spiritual renewal. You know, change always comes from the margins. And as I say, what a lot of these people are about, their critique of organized religion, is that it's not about service. It's not about spiritual depth. It does not have a nourishing, redemptive influence on public life.
Is this a turning point in the history of religion? Well, your varied and passionate responses poured in. One really stood out to us. Kate O'Brien listens to The Takeaway on WNYC Radio right here in New York City. She's not a millennial, but the issues and religious decisions she has encountered are quite millennial-esque.
I grew up Catholic, and when I moved in ninth grade, I went into a public school. And I was able to explore different ways of thinking, of asking questions, which is something I never got to do in a Catholic context as a schoolgirl.
That led you to Judaism on some level, the asking of questions.
I think that it did. When I began to ask better questions, when I found Judaism and discovered that it was about the search, it was about asking questions and learning how to ask better questions, not only about yourself or about the tradition or about the texts, but really about how do I take this into the world and make it an experience and teach others then.
So you find what seems like a home, but then even in your life, you discovered the limits of Judaism.
Yes, I've absolutely discovered those. I was in rabbinical school, in fact, for about half of the ultimate term of 6 years. So I completed 3 years. And because I came out in that time, I was made to leave rabbinical school. And that really spun me into a very different place. And I did a different kind of studying. I engaged much more in Jewish culture than I ever thought was possible.
But bluntly, I mean, when you come out as gay and, you know, you're in this kind of, oh, let's study, let's ask really important questions, you know, la, 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 all of a sudden you realize there's a backstory in religion. And the backstory is maybe patriarchal. Maybe it's, you know, we don't do that. That's not a line we're going to cross. Mm-hmm. Please don't bring up in public these issues that we'd prefer not to talk about. Mm-hmm. And religions are often about the backstory as much as they are about the journey and the study.
Yes, it is. And I think there are platitudes like that that come forward because we are embarrassed to discuss that backstory at times. Going back to the millennials, however, there are ways in which their identities are much more fluid than even mine were growing up. So you can be gay and culturally Jewish and a social activist and vegan. The older generations, and I wouldn't consider myself longly ancient or anything, but I think we're learning from the millennials about what's possible, about what we can do and who we can be, whereas in certain situations, we have constricted ourselves to what we thought we had to be.
You know, you make a point that Krista Tippett made on this show, that they are teaching us that there is perhaps a moment now to rethink religion and to rethink a belief in God and to rethink our notions of spirituality. Mm-hmm. But they're young people. They're kids. They need guidance as well. When a millennial comes to you and says, I don't believe in God, I'm an atheist, mm-hmm. and don't try to argue me out of it, what do you say?
I think that as an educator myself, my principle is to meet people where they are and then to help them ask those questions and understand what comes next. So, for example, you had said before that perhaps a millennial or someone else enters Judaism through a cultural route and then comes toward the big J, which is the religious side. I don't necessarily think that's either true or necessary. You know, you're absolutely right. When I was 20, could I have imagined that I would have been Catholic, Protestant, Jewish, and married an Episcopal priest? No, I would have told you were absolutely out of your mind. But now that I'm here and I see the path that led me here, admittedly, some of it is still in shadow. But when I can put that together, I really can't imagine being anywhere else. It's just my place at this time. And I hope that means I'm still evolving.
You have really complicated your life.
I have. I have. But
if you just married a nice Jew, you know?
Yeah, a nice Jewish girl.
That nice Jewish girl. Yeah, that would have solved all your problems.
My dad's come around to a lot. But
really?
Oh, my goodness, yes.
What does he say about all this?
My dad and I have really evolved our relationship from a place that was, I think, difficult and very perplexing to both of us, to a place where he attended our wedding and embraced us. I couldn't have more support from all of my parents if I could try.
When you say there are things still in the shadow, without betraying any confidences, what do you mean and how is your journey continuing?
I think that part of that shadow area for me is how do I now approach Judaism as a religion? I don't know, however, where I will be accepted and not accepted. Having a Christian wife means that I can't take part in certain communities. Being a convert through the conservative movement means that whole swaths of the Jewish community don't think that I'm Jewish. But they're my people. They're my home. And I try as best I can to make a place there while staying true to parts of myself that are not as well accepted in certain corners. No one can take away what I've created for myself.
Well, Kate O'Brien, thanks so much.
It's absolutely my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Right. Kate O'Brien is the director of education at the Workman's Circle, an American Jewish fraternal organization.
The Takeaway is supported by Lumosity.com, the brain training program designed by neuroscientists and used by 50 million people, created to improve memory and attention. More at Lumosity.com.
Earlier this year, we had the insane idea of hosting a haiku competition for bike riders, because how many times do you get off your bicycle after a terrific ride and say to yourself, I wish I had a pen to write down this terrific haiku I thought of? Well, it turned out to be an absolutely brilliant idea from our senior producer, Irva Gunja. Your submissions poured in the thousands. They evoked a wide range of emotion, from hilarious to angry to wholesome and sweet. Our delightfully beleaguered panel judges picked 10 winners. You might remember hearing a few of them on the air.
Training wheels are gone.
At the speed of bike.
I fly, spin by.
But a number were stolen.
I still ride with him.
I adjust my helmet strap.
Texting girl in front of me.
My spirit soars.
His and hers cycling.
Old man dreams of the wind on the road.
But there was one winning haiku with a big story behind it. Remember this one?
He gave me a bike. Lovingly. Now he's gone. I still ride with him.
Mimi Boothby, a listener on KUOW in Seattle. She turned 62 years old yesterday, one of our 10 winners in the Takeaway Bike Challenge. A lot of you and all of us here at the Takeaway wanted to know the story behind that haiku. Turns out the he was her late husband, an avid cyclist who inspired her own love of the sport.
I was married for 35 years to a wonderful guy who was a go-getter, and I was a slug. And one day I said, train me. And so he did. And eventually he bought me this awesome, awesome bicycle, kind of like a bike I always wished I had, and now I do.
Tell me about your rides and how he would train you without being... I mean, I imagine having your spouse train you could get a little bit annoying after a while.
Oh, believe me, sometimes it was annoying. He would always like to go up hills, and I would be always groaning, another hill? Can't we? Isn't there a better way? So then he'd take me on flat rides. And then if there was a little hill, he'd tease me about that.
And for all that riding and all that training and for all that being ahead of you, he passed before you did.
He got cancer. It took him fast. Well, he fought for his life, and he lost, like a lot of people do with cancer. And he asked me almost the day before he died, are you going to keep riding? And I said, well, of course I am.
What's it like to ride on your own now?
Well, that's the thing. I ride with him. He's always right there when I'm riding. I mean, when I go up a hill, I'm saying, hey, help me breathe, because I start gasping because I'm just not that strong. Or if I'm going down a really nice, pretty road, it's just like going with him. And if I have to make a decision and I'm not sure about, I hope that he's at my shoulder because I'm not sure what to do. it's kind of like my date with him.
Where's that bike now?
The bike is in the garage where it's safe under lock and key, and I'll probably ride it today or tomorrow.
And his bike?
Oh, that's another sad story. It was stolen a week before he died.
Oh, for heaven's sakes.
Yeah, that's kind of a drag. But the good news is, with the insurance, my son is having his own custom bike built, because my husband was planning to give that bike to my son.
Well, congratulations.
Thank you again. It was fun.
Mimi Boothby listens to The Takeaway from KUOW in Seattle, Washington, and was one of our winning haiku writers. We got a lot of bike stories along with our haikus, and later this hour we'll hear about one very special bike that you could imagine as the star of a heartwarming movie.
You know, this one stood out. It was almost brand new, blue tires, blue pads on it, you know, the handbrakes, blue seat. It was a really nice bike. Everybody wanted to ride my bike, even though they had their own bikes. They wanted to get on a Huffy.
How a blue and white Huffy bike turned out to be a gift from a father a young boy never knew. You can't make this stuff up. Later this hour, stay with us. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. And earlier this year, we did a series on the value of letter writing.
There's nothing quite like a letter written by a 19-year-old that addresses the parents as respected parents and then signs it yours with much respect and the full name. That's the kind of writing we don't see anymore.
That's Martha Tuck Rosett, author of When People Wrote Letters, recalling a simpler time before computers and email, when people took out quill pens and wrote each other letters. Ballpoint pens. I mean, can you even remember those times? Well, as a part of that series, we asked you about the worst kind of letter, rejection letters. Your experiences on the receiving end of the dreaded rejection letter poured in, but one story stood out because of the sheer resolve of the recipient, Jeff Kernay. When faced with a rejection, he dug in his heels and refused to accept what seemed absolutely inevitable. Jeff Kernay is a Takeaway listener and retired speech pathologist residing in South Carolina.
I won't say I don't take no for an answer, but it's unsatisfactory. So being an ex-Navy guy, you know, you keep moving forward. Failure's not an option.
What happened to you? Tell me the story of your rejection from the University of Rhode Island and how you dealt with it.
I had just finished with the military, and I decided that it was time to go to college. They said I didn't quite meet the expectations that they had. So they sent me a letter saying, unfortunately, we do not see you as a student here at the University of Rhode Island. Well, as soon as I got that letter, I got dressed up the next morning, slacks and shirt and tie and a jacket, and went down to the admissions office and spoke to the gal who's the secretary to the dean of admissions. And I told her that I want to meet the dean. And she said, take a seat. Well, that day went by. I got there about 10 and left about 2 or 3 o'clock. And she said, I'm not sure if he'll see you or not, but if you'd like to return, you can. If not, then perhaps you can go through another path. Well, I drove home and said to myself, uh-uh. And so the next day, for a total of 5 days, I sat in front of her in her office from 10 in the morning till about 2 or maybe even 3 o'clock in the afternoon, until finally he came out, and then we talked and he pointed me in the right direction.
Well, what was the next step then?
After that, he told me to go to the extension in Providence, and I took a series of tests called the CLEP test, C-L-E-P, and I think I took 5 tests. It took about 8 hours. And they told me at the university, well, it's going to take 3 or 4 months to get this information back to you. And so I ended up taking myself back out to California, waiting for them to hear me. And finally, they sent me a letter and said, congratulations, you know, you've earned a year of college credits. And with that good news, I left San Francisco and returned to the University of Rhode Island.
And you got decent grades. So what'd you do?
Yeah. Well, the first semester they put me in botany, and I thought to myself, there's nothing I can do with this. But during that time, I took a public speaking course and fell in love with it. And so the doors opened up to get a job after I went through graduate school. And in graduate school, I actually did my best work. I got straight A's, and I also ended up teaching public speaking at that university.
And you raised a son through all this.
Yes, sir. I had a saying that I gave to my son and started telling him when he was basically like a little zygote. I said, Ross, number one, you be a gentleman, and number two, do your job. And he finally came up to me at 9 years of age and said, Dad, I now know what you mean for those two expressions. I said, well, good for you that you're going to take them with you the rest of your life.
Jeff Kernay, thanks so much.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Surely some motivational words there from Jeff Kernay, a Takeaway listener and retired speech pathologist residing in South Carolina. This past year, a little series we did on the importance of letter writing caught the attention of listener Mindy Labasi. She told us that she and her long-lost high school letter-writing boyfriend had been out of touch for nearly 30 years. And while it was letters that originally moved Mindy's heart, she told us about an unusual letter-writing impulse from her old boyfriend Lou that reclaimed Mindy's heart and rekindled something more than just pen pals. Takeaway listeners, now husband and wife, Mindy and Lou Labasi came to our studios with a story of just what a big deal letter writing can be.
I guess when we first started dating 30 years ago, there's no texting, no cell phones, no instant communication. So you did romantic things like you bought Valentine's cards or birthday cards or you left notes for each other. It was a different type of way of courting your girlfriend at the time.
And he was a bit of a writer.
He sent me, in fact, when we first started dating, it was just before Valentine's Day back in 1981. And so I got a very lovely Valentine's Day card back then, and then, you know, birthday cards and things like that.
And little notes, and after a while you had quite a collection.
I still have it. All those years later.
But the letter-writing campaign by itself didn't sustain your relationship in the early going. What happened, Mindy?
We
were young. Mindy had her sights set on leaving for school, going away. I was just finishing college at the time. We sort of drifted apart.
He dumped me.
There we go. He did.
And that was after about a year. We dated for about a year.
And you dumped her.
I dumped her and started working.
And after I typed his resume, by the way.
Really? Get out of here.
I typed his resume on his old Smith Corona typewriter. And I was not a typist, mind you. I told my typing teacher that I would have a secretary. I would never need to know how to type. But I typed his resume. And then the job that he got, after we had split up, he ended up marrying one of the girls from that job.
Unfortunately.
Yes.
So this is the unfortunate dark part of the story, right? Right, right.
No,
so time goes on, right? Yeah. Right. And?
I was married for 25, 26 years. Wound up getting divorced, separating from my wife. Had two lovely girls, though, in the meantime. Mm-hmm. And I wind up saying, okay, let's find Mindy, because I thought of Mindy every day throughout the last 30 years. She was more than just, you know, one of my girlfriends. I think she was the girlfriend. And I Google Mindy's name. All these things come up, and I'm looking and I'm saying, math teacher, Georgia? I'm like, this doesn't sound right.
And when not we, just any math teacher.
And not just
actually,
any math teacher.
The Google comes up because her math team is like a standout.
Absolutely, right. And she's the star math teacher and all these things. And I'm saying to myself, when we dated, she wanted to be on the Supreme Court. She wanted to be a lawyer. So now the internet, I'm like, okay, I find her email address. And after many months of hemming and whoring, I get the courage to send an email.
Anonymously.
Anonymously. Well, I had this personal email account that doesn't have my name attached to it. And I just wrote a little note. I said, are you the same Mindy Dess that went to Levittown Division High School in the early 80s? I think we used to date. And I'm sitting there debating, send, not, send, not, send, not. And I'm like, okay, you know, the heck with it. Send.
Send.
And off to lunch I go. And I
got the email, and it was administrative assistance week. So I was covering for the school secretary so she could go out to lunch. And one of my friends was there, and I said, oh, I got an email. I don't know who it's from. And my friend Meredith said, oh, you got to respond. It's too exciting. I said, I don't know.
So there wasn't a clue in there.
I had no idea. It was just initials, and it wasn't his initials.
Mm.
And so I had no idea what it was. So I did. I responded, and something to the effect of, the 80s was a long decade, and I dated a lot of men. Which one are you? And so,
nice.
And then I got an email back saying, well, I'll give you a hint. I took you to your junior prom. So I knew who it was. And we started emailing back and forth. And that was in April. And I was coming up to New York for the first time in several years and met him. And bing, bang, boom. A year later, he proposed, got down on bended knee, proposed. And a little over a year after that, we got married.
I can hear the talk in the Levittown.
Oh, it's hysterical.
You'll never guess who's back together again.
Oh, it's hysterical. All my girlfriends remembered him. Yeah. All my girlfriends. My mother even remembered him.
So why did you reach out and tell us this story?
I did. I listened to your show on the drive home from work when I leave early enough. And I heard what's the best letter you ever received? And so I called in. I got the best story. And the first Valentine's Day that Lou and I were back together, I got 29 Valentine's Day cards, one for every year that we had been apart and one for that year. And in each card, Lou wrote a stanza of a poem that he had written. And so I got one stanza of a poem in each card as I progressed throughout the years. And so
you're a romantic fellow there.
He is.
You did have a little work that you needed to do to make up for the...
I had a lot to make up.
That's exactly what he said in all his cards. That was like the big, you know, running theme was, and I have a lot to make up for after all these years.
Yeah. And so, the closing line was, it's always been you.
Mm-hmm.
It's always been you.
He's much more romantic than I am.
And what do both of you have to be thankful for this year, do you think?
We have a lot to be thankful for.
I'm just thankful for my wife. I mean, I made her wait 27 years, but I'm the happiest person in the world right now. I have so much to be thankful for. I have a wonderful wife who's a true partner, a wonderful partner. And we just have so much fun when we're together.
Me too.
Yeah, absolutely. Everything is fun.
We have a lot of fun.
Yeah.
And I'm grateful, really thankful, that Lou has two wonderful daughters that I get to share with. And I'll get to be a grandma one day. So that'll be really nice.
Mindy and Lou, happy Thanksgiving, and thanks so much.
And
thank
you.
Give me a ticket for an aeroplane. Ain't got time to take a fast train. Lonely days are gone, I'm going home. My baby just wrote me a letter. I don't care how much money I gotta spend. Got to get back to my baby again. Lonely days are gone, I'm a-going home. My baby just wrote me a letter.
So what if you sat down at the Thanksgiving table and there's the entire family and you're just a little kid? You don't recognize Aunt Hetty and Uncle Harold. Is that Vernon, Gladys's stepdad? I mean, the faces don't ring a bell, some of them. How are kids supposed to keep all the faces in a big family straight? Well, what if one of those faces everyone seems to know except you, and everyone wants you to meet him? And by the way, he's the coolest dude at the table. One of our listeners, Buddha Calhoun in Detroit, had an experience like this, only it wasn't about Thanksgiving. It was about a blue bike, a black Camaro, and a guy he learned was his biological father before he had a chance to even know him. That blue and white huffy bike was the sole connection between Buddha and his dad, a man he met only once as a boy. Buddha told us the story of how for years he and that bike would search the streets of Detroit looking for the dad that got away.
You know, riding a bike just in those days was freedom. You know, you got away from the house. You got away from arguments or, you know, seeing drug paraphernalia laying around, you know. So we would go. I mean, at a young age, we literally were all around Detroit City. We used to imagine we were in jets because this particular street we used to fly down, we can go as fast as we could, you know, not worrying about cars coming from either way. And we would race down the street maybe 100 times a day. So it was, in a sense, we were actually flying away from, you know, the troubles of the neighborhood, you know, the aggravation at home. You know, it was freedom. And that's exactly how I felt. Felt free riding that bike.
And the story of the bike became a much deeper story about your family.
Yeah, unfortunately, yeah. I remember getting in a bike, and the bike was sweet. You know, this one stood out. It was almost brand new, blue tires, blue pads on it, you know, the handbrakes, blue seat, you know, reflectors. It was a really nice bike. Everybody wanted to ride my bike. Even though they had their own bikes, they wanted to get on a Huffy. One particular day, this guy pulls up in a Camaro, and everyone is crazy about this certain guy getting out the car, my grandmother, my aunties. And we're looking like, well, who is this guy? And he talks to them for a second, and then they keep pointing me out. And he comes to me, he grabs me, and they say, go take him upstairs to see your mom. And that's when we seen the bike on the way up the steps. And he said, whose bike is that? I said, this is my bike. My dad bought it for me. He's like, oh, okay. And I took him to see my mom and went back outside to play.
And, of course, the big fact that only you didn't know was what?
About 3 days later, my mom pulls me to the side. She said, well, you know the guy that came over the other day in that Camaro? She said, that was your biological father. And I can remember just standing there, speechless, like, what? I remember when she told me that, I'm thinking, I just told this guy that my dad bought me this bike. And I'm looking, you know, when I looked at him, he looked so familiar, not knowing as a kid that eventually I will grow up to look like this guy. So the bike, you know, I would ride it every day, but I kept thinking, my biological father thinks that I don't know who he is now. At that point in my age, the guy who was playing that, you maybe seen him maybe 3 or 4 times at age 7. And, you know, being raised by my mom, she was dealing with substance abuse at that time. So I still was looking for some type of family or some type of love values, you know. And when I met this guy, he seemed so embracing and concerned. And then hearing that news and then knowing that he, you know, he pulled off, I'm thinking, will he ever come back? You know, will he come check me out? And, you know, he never did.
So the blue Huffy became a kind of magical search for your dad horse that you rode as a little kid every day?
Yeah, it did. Exactly. I remember one day I was on a bike, and we had these old family reunion shirts, and my name was on the back of the shirt. But I'm on the bike, and I'm thinking about my biological father because he seemed like he had everything going. You know, he had a brand new Camaro. He was really clean cut. And as I'm on a bike, this guy who kind of resembles him from my memory, he calls out my name. He says, Buddha. And I stop and I turn around. He like, what's up? And the guy kept going. I'm like, who is that? And so I tell my cousin, I said, this guy just called my name as I was riding by him. He said, that's because your name is on the back of your shirt. I'm like, oh, okay. So in a way, I'm thinking after I'm riding the bike, maybe I'll run into this guy again, or maybe he'll pull back up in the Camaro, you know, talk to me. But, you know, that incident never happened.
What happened to the Huffy?
Eventually, my cousin asked to ride it again, took it up to the little corner store that was exactly around the corner from us to get some penny candy. And he said when he came out, the bike was gone. I remember just putting my head down and walking up the same stairs, going in my room and shutting the door. the bike was gone. It took a lot away from me. A little piece of me left with that bike.
But you did find your biological dad eventually.
Yeah, I was 35 years old, 35 years old by the time I met him again. So one day my wife, she was like, would you like to meet your biological father? I mean, you know, we got the internet now. You know, it probably would, a couple clicks, we might be able to find him. And I think about 4 days later, she said, guess what? I said, what? She said, I found your dad. I remember going home, you know, took my shower, and I was sitting on the edge of the bed with the number. And I called, and he picked up. He said, this is Derek. Who is this? I said, this is Buddha. He's like, oh, my God. Oh, my God. He was, like, really nervous. He said, you know, all my life, you have been on my mind. I've been looking for you. And then we made plans to meet up 2 days after that. And I drove my family over to his house and came through the door, and it was like, wow. And, you know, he looked just like me, and he was hugging on me, wouldn't let me go. And we went upstairs, and we talked for hours. It was a good relationship from the start. He was like a best friend that I never met, and we got reacquainted. And while I'm talking to him, I'm thinking, you know, I kind of missed out on this.
Hmm. You mentioned that when that blue Huffy got stolen, you lost a piece of yourself. Have you gotten it back, that piece?
Yeah, I got a lot more, you know, because as I realized today that how significant that bike played in my life. And having a young man as a child today, my son is 19, and I'm looking at him, and some days he gets on his bike and he disappears for a while, you know. But I understand that freedom as a young man to get on your bike and just go, feel the wind, see stuff, come back. And at first when the bike got stolen, I felt like, you know, my freedom was taken away. But as I'm getting older now, I realize that, you know, freedom is much more.
I have a feeling a lot of folks are going to remember a blue Huffy for a very long time after that story.
Yes, I hope so. Buddha's bike.
Happy Thanksgiving, Buddha.
Happy Thanksgiving. Thanks.
Buddha Calhoun is a Takeaway listener who lives in Detroit, Michigan. And as we leave you this hour, we want to take a moment to thank all of you. Our show couldn't be what it is without your contributions. You drive our conversations. You remind us that this show isn't about us here in the studio. It's about you, your stories, what you know. Weigh in by finding us at Twitter at The Takeaway, or you can find us at Facebook.com/The Takeaway. And if you want to get an early jump on all our conversations, be a part of our listener response network, sign up for our texts. We'll send you one a day where we ask you a question featured on the next day's show. Your voice just becomes part of the on-air conversation. Text the word START to 69866. That's START to 69866. Thanks so much for listening. Enjoy the rest of your day. Have a great weekend. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.